from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is November the 11th, Monday morning, 2019, Veterans Day, and we honor the veterans of our military services, and we've had a couple segments on in the last week and a half or so about veterans issues and so on. Today, we're actually going to add one more. I've got Robert Burke coming in. He's director of the State Office of Veterans Affairs. He's coming in the second part of this hour, 9:35-ish to 10, and talking to us about what are some of the things the State of Vermont's Office of Veterans Affairs does for veterans that perhaps maybe the VA federal agency does not do. We'll check in with Robert Burke about that. In the second hour of the program, we're going to be talking about Act 46 and some of the concerns that school consolidation law has raised, particularly about our small rural schools around Vermont. Of course, we've had a couple segments recently about all the consternation in the Harwood Union School District, possibly closing a school, perhaps in Faceton. In fact, a vote there is coming up this week as to what the school board will be putting out for a bond issue, and perhaps a school closing vote coming up in town meeting day in March. First, I wanted to start out this morning, as we often do on Monday mornings here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM, with our guest Colin Mine. He's the managing editor of VTDigger.org, which, as usual, has quite a number of excellent and some downright fascinating stories this morning. We're going to talk about artificial intelligence, for instance, and Colin Mine joins me on the phone this morning. Good morning, Colin.
Morning, Dave.
And I want to check in with you and find out a little bit about some of the stories you have this morning. Actually, let's start with some news out of Washington, because I meant to mention that in just at the top of the second hour of the show, we're going to have a correspondent from CBS News. I believe Steve Dorsey will be joining us to talk about the latest in the impeachment inquiry, where, of course, public hearings begin later this week on Capitol Hill. This is all on the House side. Eventually, if the House approves articles of impeachment, they will go to the Senate, where there's already a little bit of a tiff developing, apparently, between Vermont's senior senator Patrick Leahy and Mitch McConnell, the majority leader. What's going on with that, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, Patrick Leahy, the Senate is often sort of the place where the buck stops as far as sort of final decision making, whether it's presidential appointments or Supreme Court appointments. And in this case, they're the sort of trial chamber if an impeachment were to get to them. And Patrick Leahy, Vermont's senior senator, a longtime prosecutor, or not really a longtime prosecutor, a prosecutor for about a decade before he began his long and illustrious career in Washington, has always sort of talked about how it's really important for senators not to make up their mind before deliberations begin on some of these big decisions that they have to make. And even when the political tides seem, you know, to be moving in an obvious direction, Patrick Leahy will sort of reserve, his decision until he's heard the facts and that sort of thing. And in this case, his colleague, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader there in the Senate, is doing no such thing and has basically said that regardless of what people have to say when these public hearings begin, he will acquit the president. And because the Republicans have the majority in the Senate, that would make it seem like, impeachment is all but impossible. Of course, you know, facts could emerge, things could change. I mean, nothing is ever certain. But it does seem like the Republicans in the Senate are already sort of saying this is a hoax and getting ahead of the House and saying that when it gets to us, it's going nowhere.
Do you think that, is your understanding of McConnell's position that they'll even go to a full trial, or will it be sort of a dismissal out of the gate?
I mean, so he said that he believes the Constitution does require the Senate to conduct a sort of impeachment trial, and that that would begin essentially as soon as impeachment occurs in the House. What that process would look like, I mean, I think we've seen with the House here just how sort of flexible and, non-rigid the laws and constitutions is when it comes to impeachment. I mean, the House effectively sort of wrote its own rules, passed those rules, and that's the rules that they're now following. So you'd imagine the Senate could do something fairly similar, that McConnell believes that some sort of trial has to happen. But the sort of contours of what that would look like, who's involved, and how long it would take. You'd imagine that Republican senators could essentially write those rules, pass them the way that the House has, and then sort of follow them in this trial phase.
I saw an interesting piece over the weekend, and for the life of me, I can't remember where exactly, but it was talking about Senator Leahy and the role he played in organizing talks back in, I believe it was 1998, when Bill Clinton was impeached by the House, and that went over to the Senate. And Leahy said that he and Republican leadership and Democratic leadership gathered in the old Senate chamber by themselves, no aides, no press, nobody outside, just senators, and kind of hashed out what the rules were going to be for the Clinton impeachment trial, adding, of course, that he was hoping that there would be a repeat of that this time. Sounds like he may not be very happy this time.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to be a bipartisan effort. And you know, McConnell did, I should note, sort of hedged his comment and did say that, you know, I'm pretty sure how it's likely to end. If it were today, I don't think there's any question it would lead to a removal. So he is sort of leaving something open for the facts on the ground to change, I suppose. But, you know, the idea that McConnell might ask Leahy to come sit down with some of the other senior senators and figure out a sort of bipartisan way forward certainly seems remote, given the political dynamics that are currently the reality down there in Washington.
Yeah, and of course there is this whole alternative story out there. Some Republicans have been pushing that Ukraine meddled in the 2016 election, not Russia, even though the Internet Research Agency, which was a Russian front organization, had all of its data transfers and so on traceable back to St. Petersburg, not to Kiev, but that's I guess neither here nor there in some people's minds. Ukraine allegedly was the leader in meddling in the U.S. election in 2016, and of course the Bidens were some masterminds behind the scene. There's now talk that Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, would be brought in to testify either at the House, in the House proceedings, or in the Senate proceedings, or both. Anything from Leahy on that?
Well, my understanding is that the House Republicans have sent their witness list, so they're allowed to request witnesses to give public testimony as part of this hearing process. However, Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, a Democrat, is able to reject those requests. So they put in a list that, as you said, did include Hunter Biden, his business partner, at Burisma, which is this Ukrainian energy company where he sat on the board and has been the sort of focus of these corruption claims by President Trump and his allies. But Adam Schiff has indicated that he's going to reject that. So you imagine that folks, that will again sort of stoke the Republican talking points that this whole thing is a fraud, that they won't even allow the sort of people who Trump was accusing of corruption to come in to defend themselves and that sort of thing. But it does look like that's going to play out in the House. And we have not had Leahy weigh in on that. And he hasn't really been weighing in on the day-to-day sort of advances of what's going on in the House, taking the position that that's really not his business, to the extent that he's waiting for things to move over to the Senate before he starts really engaging, I think.
Yeah, and that's probably a sensible strategy on his part. I mean, who needs to weigh in if you don't have to? So, hey, let's shift our focus, Colin, to a little bit of state news here. Lots of interesting stuff going on. One of the things happening is that we used to think of cyanobacteria blooms, these blue-green algae blooms, as a summertime phenomenon, but they seem to be extending into fall. Is that right?
Yeah, and into October at least. I think that now that the sort of ice comes, they tend to die off a bit. But it was another summer where their sort of impact in Vermont and just the scope and scale of these blue-green cyanobacteria blooms, which, you know, sort of come up on the shores of lakes and really make them unusable in a lot of ways, happen in Lake Champlain. Lake Carmi has been designated a lake in crisis, and a number of other lakes as well. But interestingly, and this is what our story today sort of focused on, is that despite them becoming more widespread and people sort of recognizing the public health risk of them, a couple dogs died this summer because of exposure to cyanobacteria. There's not any state rules and regulations around what is acceptable. There's no testing programs to sort of make sure that there's not a public threat, which is the case with, you know, other sort of classes of chemicals or harmful biological equivalents, I suppose. So anyway, the current system was set up about 15 years ago, and it basically is volunteers go around the lake looking at the water and saying, we do or don't see cyanobacteria, and how sort of severe is it? And then there are sort of alerts that go out to people in those areas, depending on what people see. But a lot of advocates that we spoke to think that the state should be taking this more seriously, have some rules written around what is acceptable, what's not, and some testing programs that allow some more confidence as far as what's in the water and whether it's safe for people to be around or drinking it.
So there are testing programs where samples go to labs on E. coli, which is another pollutant that can get into water and make people and animals sick and so on. There's nothing like that for cyanobacteria?
No, there's not. I mean, the testing can be done, certainly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, I'm sure there are laboratories with that capacity, but as far as, you know, when cyanobacteria is identified in the lake, for example, to do some testing to find out how significant it is, to find out what sort of toxins are being released into the water, that doesn't exist. And, you know, there's, as I mentioned, a sort of voluntary program where folks who live around these lakes, you know, work with the state to keep an eye out for what's going on, which certainly, you know, has been helpful and effective to a certain extent. But as the sort of threat of cyanobacteria becomes more widespread, as we see, you know, pets dying because of it, as we understand, you know, it can cause a lot of problems in humans. It can cause vomiting. It can cause longer-term illnesses, that there's a desire to just do better sort of protection for people around this sort of toxin.
Wow, yeah. Hey, another topic I want to dip into this morning is this OneCare. I think people really need to familiarize themselves with OneCare. It's this new all-payer system in Vermont that is somehow processing about $1.33 billion in healthcare spending in the state, and it looks to be handling even more money in the future. But let's talk about that after a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. We'll be back more with Colin Mine of BT Digger in just a couple minutes, folks.
Fords and Chevys and Hondas, oh my! Toyotas and Nissans and Kias, oh my! Roar! The road is like the cowardly lion out there, and every once in a while, Dorothy slaps you in the face. Shame on you! Don't worry, when your vehicle needs some courage, bring it to Demers Auto Body on Route 2 in East Montpelier. From rust repair to small uh-ohs, or big tornado accidents from flying over the rainbow. The boys at Demers Auto Body are like wizards. Certified technicians with computerized estimates of repair, no poppy field will slow them down. Thinking your vehicle is the Wicked Witch, ready to upgrade to a more beautiful Good Witch? Our lot of hand-picked, pre-owned vehicles will do the job. Come on down and speak to Josh Demers about our inventory. He's like a horse of a different color, the rarest wizard of all. Demers Auto Body, taking the dent out of accident.
Sometimes life really gets in the way. We get stuck in traffic, get phone calls dropped, get our homework eaten by the dog. No, really, it happens. But of all of life's minor mishaps that come our way, getting sick or injured has to be the worst. Who has time for that? Well, thanks to the region's leading health network, there's a quick and easy way to get the treatment you need for life's minor injuries and illnesses when you can't get in to see your primary care provider. The University of Vermont Health Network has multiple walk-in care locations where you can get in, get out, and get well. There's urgent care in Colchester at the Fannie Allen campus, and express care in Berlin, and now Waterbury Center. Open 7 days a week with no appointment needed. There's on-site lab and x-ray, plus we usually have a lower copay than the ER and accept all insurance. With the multiple walk-in care locations in the University of Vermont Health Network, we're there when and where you need us for life's minor injuries and illnesses. Find the location nearest you at uvmhealth.org/walk-in.
At Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom, we realize that these days, every major service provider relies on the same technology. What makes us different is how our people deal with the customers that rely on that technology. Here's Lee Cheney, Central Office Manager.
When customers call in, we listen, we hear them, and we do the best to meet their needs. And they don't call into deaf ears. You know, we jump on it. We go right out and meet with the customers. We're a local company. They're not talking to anybody down in Boston or New York. They're talking to somebody right here in Waitsfield. And that home feeling and that local feeling is important to people. We don't just work to solve our needs for the community. We work with the community to give them back some of the things that they need. And we enjoy doing that. We're local. Come on in. We'll talk to you. And we'll figure it out.
At Waitsfield and Champlain Valley Telecom, we know that the way to be your telecom is to perform world-class customer service. For over a century, that's a challenge we've welcomed every single day.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
I don't think we've ever had a dog eat homework in our household, but we did have a dog eat some sheet music once. There was a Brahms sonata and a Mozart concerto on a music stand, and the dog jumped up, grabbed the Brahms, chewed it to bits, and I didn't know whether that meant the dog thought the Brahms was tastier or whether it wanted to spare the Mozart and destroy the Brahms. I'm still not clear on what that signaled about the dog's musical tastes, but dogs occasionally do like paper goods, and I can imagine a dog eating the homework. That's why that's sort of a thing sometimes. So anyway, we digress. Colin Mine is my guest. He's a managing editor at vtdigger.org, and we've been going through some of the top Vermont stories in the news in recent days, and one involves, and I've got to commend VT Digger on this, is this thing called OneCare, which I think a lot of Vermonters have not been familiar with, but it's playing a huge role in our healthcare system these days. If you want to catch up, read Katie Jickling's recent stories on OneCare and find out what this thing is and what kind of an impact it is playing in our healthcare system. The latest news seems to be that some of our leading unions in the state, including the State Employees Union, are balking at being covered or being part of this all-payer system. And Colin, tell us about that.
Yeah, so the current sort of phase of where OneCare is at, you know, eventually the idea is that OneCare will essentially control spending for the entire state healthcare system. Right now it's about a sixth of it, I believe. That's one-sixth. But the sort of, it's part of this five-year, we've called an experiment. They don't really like it to be called an experiment, but a five-year demonstration model where they're trying this new form of sort of healthcare insurance coverage, or not insurance coverage, but a new model for Vermont's healthcare system in which they really incentivize physicians and hospitals to do more sort of preventative care and primary care and sort of wellness programs, you know, getting people to exercise and eat right and that kind of thing, rather than incentivizing those same physicians and hospitals to you know, send patients to expensive procedures once the problem emerges, right? So a new sort of approach to healthcare that they hope will improve outcomes and save Vermonters money. We're about 3 years into the project. They haven't had any great sort of successes so far. And their biggest struggle at this point has been getting patients involved in the program. So, you know, their argument is that in order to make significant strides on the outcomes and cost front, they need to have more patients involved, to have greater scale, to be able to collect more data, and that sort of thing. So the really significant chunk of the patients that they're going for this year are the state employees, and that's the Vermont State Employees Union and the National Education Association, which together represent upwards of 60 or 70,000 people, which is about 10% of Vermont. And the sort of number of members who would be eligible for OneCare, which requires your physician and hospital to also be part of the network, is something closer to 30,000. And this year they're aiming to add 90,000 patients to OneCare. So if the state employees are not on board, they're going to miss yet another sort of patient population target. And that is worrying to them because it means they can't make a lot of the sort of goals that they've set for themselves.
What are the misgivings that state employees are voicing here?
So the executive director of Vermont State Employees Association, Steve Howard, essentially said that he, you know, they're being asked to take part in this experiment, which he called untested. And he said that they're not interested in helping someone else build their empire. You know, they're not interested in sort of throwing their members into this project in order to help the folks who run OneCare, which is a private company owned by the UVM Medical Center and Dartmouth Hitchcock, that, you know, the state employees aren't going to put their excellent health insurance on the line their excellent health care on the line because this sort of new organization wants to meet its target population goals. There's been concern that OneCare executives are paid quite a bit, that their administrative costs are very high. They've asked for something like $60 million this year for direct spending. So the other, you mentioned something like $1.3 billion, which is the amount of healthcare dollars that sort of run through OneCare. So basically go directly from Medicaid, Medicare, commercial insurers to the hospitals and physicians who are caring for people. Mm-hmm. But then there's another $60 million or so that is spent on OneCare executives, OneCare administration, as well as some programs that they fund directly.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange thing where on the one hand, it's historically been a progressive idea, you know, sort of supported by some progressives to try to organize a healthcare system that is based on this all payer model, more so than the old fee for service model. So I mean, it struck me as a little bit of incongruous, maybe, to see this statement from Steve Howard the other day, really kind of dismissing this thing. I'm not sure. Are there any incentives that the union could be offered to try to bring them around?
Yeah, well, I think what you mentioned is true, that sort of philosophically, you know, almost all of the sort of leading political voices, whether it's the unions or former Democratic governors, Democratic lawmakers, agree that this sort of change has to happen, that there needs to be some sort of major rethinking. You know, under Governor Peter Shumlin, of course, the push was for single payer, and this process was sort of born out of the failure of that process. So everyone's sort of aiming for the same sorts of outcomes, you know, people spending less money and sort of not incentivizing these expensive procedures and trying to, you know, come up with a better way of dealing with health. But I think the issue is not so much the idea behind OneCare, but the way it's been executed. And, you know, so a private company runs it, so there's very, very little transparency around how much success they're having, how they're spending their money, how much they're paying their executives. Basically, there's no sort of visibility for the public to see what's going on with OneCare. So you sort of have to take them at their word when they give reports to the regulatory agencies and that sort of thing. The state auditor, progressive Democrat Doug Hoffer, has said that he wants to audit the organization, which a number of lawmakers agreed with, although a bill that would have allowed him to do that died in the legislature last year. So you mentioned what can the unions be offered that might get them on board. One thing that Steve Howard mentioned is that he wants to see an audit of the company before the state employees sort of toss their healthcare chips into OneCare. So, you know, that might add, whether or not OneCare might be willing to do that seems unlikely. They've been very resistant to the idea that they would open their books for a full audit, but yet another sort of rather large political body or labor body, I guess, is asking for that audit.
Well, you know, it is interesting that I was a little bit surprised, frankly, as this thing developed, that OneCare did take on so many of the characteristics of really a privately held company almost, and very private sector, not much transparency, et cetera. And so I can sort of understand maybe the public employee unions here, the teachers and the state employees, are saying, well, wait a minute here. We want to I wonder if OneCare had taken on a more the role of, say, a public entity, or at least more quasi public or whatever, that would have helped its popularity, so shall we say, with all of these public employees.
Yeah, and you know, the fact that it's owned by two of the biggest hospitals in Vermont, one which is just across the border in New Hampshire but serves many, many Vermonters over there in Dartmouth-Hitchcock, you know, I think doesn't help the level of public trust that, you know, you sort of take these very, very large companies at their word. I mean, there's just a desire to sort of understand, you know, the dynamics there and to allow the sort of state policymakers some insight into understanding what's happening with the company and how things are developing, so that the public can understand these sort of momentous changes that are happening in the healthcare system. And up until now, OneCare has, you know, they've explained the theories behind what they're doing and the reasons why people shouldn't worry. But I think unless you sort of are able to see the facts and the data, that they're going to have a hard time convincing people that it's all on the up and up.
Yeah, it seems like folks want to look under the hood. Hey, just a minute or so to go. Can we quickly explain what's going on with these opioid lawsuits?
Yeah, so I'm not sure DEV would have either run this podcast on last Friday or this coming Friday, but our digital editor, Mike Dougherty, did this fantastic podcast looking at a number of municipalities who are either being asked to join this national lawsuit against opioid companies, as well as speaking to the Attorney General about a few lawsuits that he's filed against McKesson and Cardinal and Purdue and the Sackler family, and sort of what it all means for whether communities can claw back some of what they've lost to the opioid epidemic.
It's a really important part of what VT Digger offers, these podcasts, folks. Worth checking out on the website, vtdigger.org. Colin Mayen, the managing editor there, has been my guest this first half hour. Thanks so much, Colin.
Thank you, Dave.
Alrighty, we're going to take a brief break for some CBS News at the bottom of the hour, a couple words from our sponsors, and then we're going to be talking with Robert Burke, director of the State Office of Veterans Affairs. Stay with us, folks.
Take the stress out of holiday shopping at the almost world-famous Warren Store. We have something for everyone on your list, from toys to beer, jewelry to wine, clothing to Yule logs. We have a wide selection of outerwear for men and women, all at 25% off from some of your favorite brands, such as Kool, Royal Robbins, Prana, Save the Duck, and more. Holiday cards, wrap, candles, pottery, snow globes, always friendly, knowledgeable customer service, and free gift wrapping. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli, then head upstairs to shopping heaven. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
November 11th, of course, is Veterans Day, and it's something that I have tried to mark already somewhat on this program in the last couple of weeks. We had a couple of folks come on talking about the Veterans Town Halls that occurred a week ago yesterday in St. Johnsbury, Colchester, and Rutland. Some powerful remarks by veterans just sharing their own stories about what their experiences in the military theaters around the world, and also since coming home, what that's been like to readjust to life in the civilian world. And then last Monday, we had a special guest, Jamie Lee Thurston, came in joining a couple people from Norwich University about an event this past weekend, a concert Jamie Lee Thurston performed at Norwich on Saturday evening. And so... but I wanted to mark the day itself just by refreshing everybody out there that Vermont, you know, we think of the federal government having a Department of Veterans Affairs. They run the VA hospitals and they do a lot of services to veterans out there. But the state of Vermont also has its own Office of Veterans Affairs. We're going to find out a little bit about its role and what it provides for folks who have served in the military. Joining me this morning is Robert Burke. He is director of the Office of Veterans Affairs, which is part of the military department, which also includes the Vermont National Guard. And the Robert Burke is a Navy veteran and who I think retired, he told me, at the rank of commander in 2012 after 28 years of service in that branch. He's been with the Vermont Office of Veterans Affairs for about 5 years. Robert Burke, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And so tell us a little bit about the State Office of Veterans Affairs. What are its most important roles?
Sure. I think if you look across three lines of operation, I like to think of them. So we're a repository for DD-214s. So that's your Department of Defense Form 214, better known as your discharge. And so we use that in qualifying and certifying eligibility of veterans for different state and federal programs. And then we have service officers who work in the office, and they will help veterans file claims through the federal VA for disability benefits, pension, et cetera. And then we operate the cemetery down in Randolph Center.
I see. Okay. So those are three pretty discrete roles, really, when you think about this. It sounds like the first is a kind of a credentialing role. Is that right?
Correct. So it's determining eligibility for whether it's state programs, federal programs, all sorts of things like that.
What are some of the programs that one would be thinking about enrolling in or participating in that their status as a veteran would be a factor.
So through the Department of Motor Vehicles, we have a veteran's designation on a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
There are a variety of veterans registration plates, depending on when you served. There is free access to state parks, and that's run through your town halls. There's a property tax reduction for veterans that are 50% or greater disabled. Free hunting and fishing licenses for veterans that are 60% or greater disabled. We have I sit on the Vermont Veterans Homeless Committee, so we're looking to bring homelessness for veterans to a functional end, which doesn't mean that there are no longer any homeless veterans in Vermont, but it means that there's a means to identify them and to offer them help and find them a way to permanent housing. So those are kind of an overview.
And all of these things require a status as a veteran, and that's what you track through these documents, the DOD 214, the discharge notices each individual person gets on leaving the military, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And those discharges, as a layperson, I actually tried to join the Navy decades ago and wasn't accepted because of my eyesight. I guess I'm basically a 4F. So, so I'm only passingly familiar with a lot of the stuff, frankly. But tell us about the different levels of discharge. There are, I know there's an honorable discharge, there's a dishonorable discharge, I guess. What is in that list?
Correct. So if you kind of look at the pecking list, so it's an honorable discharge.
Mm-hmm.
It's a general discharge or under honorable conditions. And then there is other than honorable bad conduct discharge.
I see.
So for the programs that the state offers or the majority of the federal programs require an honorable, general, or under honorable conditions.
And so if you discharged under other than honorable conditions, you are not eligible for these veterans programs.
You are not, but you can request to have it adjudicated and upgraded. A lot of people, it was PTSD mm-hmm. that led them to mismanage their behavior and ended up, having them put out with a other than honorable discharge.
And that would be... really, you have to come down to the conclusion it's no fault of the individual if they are have some injury during their service which causes PTSD, and then that triggers behaviors which may have initially triggered this other than honorable discharge. You want to reach out to that person and say, hey, let's talk about forgiveness here or whatever.
Correct. And we do not a whole lot of them. I mean, it really is a process
mm-hmm.
for you to prove that was the cause of your going astray.
Yeah, so is this actually these upgrades you mentioned, are they done through your office, or is that something you have to do with the DOD?
No, we can assist people in filing them,
mm-hmm.
but those are done through the individual services.
I see. Okay, that kind of makes sense because they are the issuers of the discharge papers, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, it's. What percentage of people who come out of the military are discharged in other than honorable circumstances?
I don't have the statistics in front of me, but mm-hmm. I'd say it's in the single-digit percentile.
Okay, so very, very small minority, really.
Correct.
Okay. That's an unfortunate outcome, which thankfully does not apply to the vast majority of folks who have served in the military. Talk to me a little bit about PTSD, since that is such an issue. It really has become kind of the headline around veterans' needs and so on in the last 15 or 20 years, I would say, certainly since the Iraq War. Is PTSD something that is services generally offered by the VA and the federal system, or is that something your office gets into as well?
No, we don't offer any sort of mental health services. Those are all through the federal VA.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of not private, public organizations that would do it, private nonprofits, the National Alliance for the Mental for Mental Illness, just being one. But the VA has an incredible program. I mean, the Center for PTSD Research is right down at White River Junction.
Is that the National Center? I mean, is that the place where they do PTSD research on a nationwide basis? I didn't know that.
That it is. Yes.
That's quite a flag to wave down there then, because as we know, this is an issue for veterans around the country. And are folks traveling in from different places around the country to visit the VA in White River in order to get the latest PTSD treatment?
I don't think that they're doing that at that location. I mean, I think they're looking at research and they're putting out protocols for things to be done at local VA medical centers
all around the country,
community-based, you know, outpatient clinics and things like that around the country, and looking at the latest research from the public side, from the private side, to see what's new and what's effective and what's not.
Folks, our local number here in Waterbury is 244-1777. Our toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. Robert Burke is my guest, Commander Robert Burke, U.S. Navy, and now Director of the Office of Veterans Affairs for the state of Vermont. And if you have any questions or comments you would like the Director of the State Office of Veterans Affairs to hear or answer, this is your chance here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And we do have a caller on the line, Fred from Newbury. Good morning, Fred. Fred, are you with
us? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, good. Hey, as far as PTSD is concerned, was there more PTSD in the volunteer army than the draft army?
More in the volunteer army or the draft army? Any thoughts there, Robert Burke?
Post-traumatic stress has been around for millennia, and we just kind of have given it different names, soldier's heart, shell shock, things like that. I mean, we finally kind of put a terminology to it to kind of break it down and understand.
There's an interesting thing about shell shock. Shell shock occurred during World War I and World War II. That was a big deal there. But the problem was you stayed in the Army for the duration of the war. So you could have been in combat for 2 years, whereas the Vietnam War, most people were in combat only 1 year, and then they went home. And the draft took care of most of the combat positions. If you volunteered for the Army back during the Vietnam War, it was called a guaranteed enlistment. So if you volunteered for a non-combat arm position and you got it, chances are you stayed in that. And if it wasn't called for in Vietnam, you never went to Vietnam.
Fred, are you a veteran yourself?
Yeah, I was in the Air Defense Artillery. And my job was to protect Chicago from Russian bears and Russian bison. That was the code name for the Intercontinental bombers. So my duty basically was a garrison soldier for the whole 3 years that I was in. But I still said I was on the front line.
You were based in Illinois somewhere?
No, I was based in Indiana. I was on the eastern side
of Chicago.
I protected the eastern flank. Then we had one in the southern flank, and then we had another battery in the western flank.
What years were you in the service, Fred?
I joined the Army in 66, and I got out of the Army in 69, and that was the height of the Vietnam War.
How did you miss service in Vietnam?
Because it wasn't called for. A Nike Hercules was an air defense missile for intercontinental bombers, and there was no threat of intercontinental bombers in Vietnam.
Yeah, okay.
So it was never called for.
So your particular division of the service just wasn't put in into Vietnam.
Yeah, right. A friend of mine graduated from high school, and he went in the Army, and he had a technical job, and his technical job was radio maintenance, and he was stationed in Vietnam, but he was behind the lines. He wasn't a frontline soldier.
Right.
And when he came home, he told me, he says, hey, whatever you do, Fred, don't take the draft. If you take the draft, you're going to be a combat soldier because you have no choice.
All right, Fred, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, and thank you for your service. We'll leave it there for right now. But Robert Burke, you said you were 28 years in the Navy. Where did you serve?
Mostly on the East Coast, a little bit on the West Coast. So mm-hmm. I did. I started off in diving and salvage, and then so my community was diving and salvage, explosive ordnance management, and then explosive ordnance disposal. So I did diving and salvage. I did explosive ordnance management, so the weapon stations, loading ships up with munitions, things such as that.
Wow.
And then towards the end, I did a year working counter IED in Afghanistan.
So you were around some pretty lethal stuff. I mean, were there a lot of nervous moments, or was it really a pretty routine feel of the daily work?
No, it's pretty routine, you know, logistics in and out of magazines and loading. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, obviously everybody's safe and secure and understanding, you know, the risks. But it was not that you get used to it, but you understand.
Yeah. And certainly you want to show up for that job sharp and well coffeeed up and not hungover and all that good stuff. So I would think I have a question for you as a Navy guy. Did you serve in Norfolk or San Diego or?
I Norfolk, Little Creek, because that's where the amphibious base was.
Yeah.
And then again, on the West Coast in Coronado. That's where the West Coast amphibious base was, so the smaller salvage ships and things like that.
I see. And I read from time to time that there's quite a bit of concern across the military, but especially in the Navy, about these bases in a time of climate change and rising sea levels and that sort of thing. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I know that even back when I was on active duty in the early 2000s, Norfolk had been looking at environmental impact, and so they're 10 plus years into planning what the impact is going to be and what they need to do.
Eventually move inland, or they just build up their seawalls around there, or what's the plan?
I think you can only build seawalls so high before you kind of have to start to shift further inland.
Yeah. Wow. Huh.
And understand, you know, what weather and flooding and you know, 100-year events, you know, becoming more like 25-year events and what impact that has.
A lot of logistical issues there. Boy, I read a piece over the weekend in the Los Angeles Times about the Marshall Islands. There's a facility there where there was a whole lot of nuclear waste and other related materials to atomic bomb testing put there in this giant concrete dome, and now they're really worried about the whether the dome can last and survive in rising sea levels in the Pacific. And that, boy, what a mess that would be to think about trying to either move all of that or I don't know what. Let's go to a caller on the line. We have Gene from Barrie. Good morning, Gene.
Good morning. My father served in World War II, but he had a brother. His oldest brother served in World War I.
Wow.
And my father was 32 and a half when he went. He was in the Battle of the Bulge.
Uh-huh.
And he was missing in action, but he found his way back. And he came home safe and sound. I had my three brothers served in the Army, and I had a son that served 22 years in the Marines.
Wow. So you have quite a military family there, Gene.
That's right. And I thank them all. They all should be honored. All these different wars from way back. You know, right up to the present.
Well, I think there's some honor to some of these families too, and it sounds like you get a share of that, Gene. You know, given all the folks you sent off, you know, and the degree you probably had to worry about them at different times and in different places and so on.
Oh, I know. I turned 11 the month after he went in, so I can remember quite a bit. You
and
know,
your dad was 32 when he went in.
He was 32 and a half when he went in. And they called him Pop because, of course, all the other 18, 19, 20 years old.
Yeah. Wow.
But he lost a lot of friends, and he always felt bad because one time he told me, he says, I wonder if God will forgive me. And I says, for what? He says, well, you know, I killed men in the war. I said, Dad, they had wars way back in the biblical times and everything, too, you know.
Yeah.
So the good Lord knows what your purpose was, and, you know, and... I think that he'll forgive you.
And your dad had an older brother. You said he was in World War I.
My father's older brother was in World War One. He served in the Navy part-time, then the Army, too, as they said. Of course, I don't remember. I wasn't around them.
You weren't around for World War One.
No.
Yeah. Okay. But I got to tell you, that is I've never heard of that before, frankly, two siblings serving in World War One and then World War Two.
Yeah, it was quite a bit of different. My father was the youngest of four.
Uh-huh.
And next to the youngest of four, he had two older brothers, and then the younger one was a sister. So that sister had to put up with three brothers, you see.
Yeah, well, my baby sister had to put up with five older brothers. So
His sister lived to be almost 100. A couple more months, she would have been 100.
Wow. Gene, this is really fascinating. Thank you for the call, and thank you for your service as a family member of military people.
We're pleased with all of them. You know, we got to thank them all.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Gene. Great talking with you. Wow, that's awesome. I mean, have you ever heard of that before, Robert Burke?
That's a new one on me.
Yes, siblings, World War One, and then World War Two. That is just. I guess that says our wars come too close together or something. I don't know, but
I mean, there were very few, World War One veterans who then moved on to serve in World War Two.
Yeah,
as opposed to World War Two, and then they caught Korea.
Yeah,
and things like that.
For folks who were in the military for long careers, like you were, 28 years, that is a possibility, I guess. That when there's multiple conflicts, that's what you signed up for, and it really is quite something. I'd never been in the military myself, but I do have a great deal of respect for that decision that people make to go and I saw something written about this over the weekend where somebody was saying it's like signing a blank check to the United States government and the amount can be your life.
Correct.
That was quite strikingly put. I'd never seen that formulation before, but that's what the deal is, folks. And you do have to. I know a lot of people who certainly I grew up with people questioning the heck out of the Vietnam War, and then people questioned the first Gulf War and the Iraq War and et cetera. There's a lot of folks who question U.S. foreign policy, but I don't think that really diminishes much in my mind anyway. The respect due the people who they aren't coming up with the policy or formulating what we're going to do. They are merely over there. Serving and fulfilling their commitment to serve the United States of America, and that is an honorable thing.
And I think you made a good point to Gene too that the families are also to be honored because the sacrifice that they're making can be incredible.
Yeah, there ought to be a War Widows Day or something, or just a Yellow Ribbon Day or something like that as our military related holidays go. But this is Veterans Day, folks, and with me, my guest is Robert Burke. He is the director of the State Office of Veterans Affairs. We've got a few minutes to go, and once again, the local number here in Waterbury, 244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. And let me ask you, Robert Burke, as somebody who is a veteran yourself and who is in charge of the State Office of Veterans Affairs, anything you see on the VA front that you would like to see improved or expanded, or any areas where you think the federal government, its role in taking care of veterans, could be enhanced?
Well, I think being a rural state, so transportation and access to care for veterans is always an issue. I think that they have made great strides in allowing and providing for care in the community so that people don't have to make an hour and a half, 2 hour drive to a medical center or a community-based outpatient clinic. But again, I think there's been quite a few hiccups, but they're working hard to solve them because it's hard to sign up providers to provide that care when it takes 90, 120, 180 days for them to get paid. So I think that they're making really good strides. The Mission Act has helped with some of that, but they continue to work it hard.
More distributed care, it sounds like, is what you're talking about, really.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Hey, we do have another caller on the line. Let's go to Joanne in Worcester. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I was just calling up because I work for a clinic that offers free services that veterans could take advantage of.
Which free clinic is this now?
It's People's Health and Wellness Clinic in Barrie.
Uh-huh.
It serves uninsured and underinsured Vermonters. And I would love to have more veterans come through. And I'm the dental part of it. I'm a dental hygienist, and I can offer free cleanings, x-rays, and exams, and then coordinate getting them services from dentists in the area.
Wow, that's good to know. I didn't realize. I'm familiar with the People's Health and Wellness Clinic because my wife actually worked there as a staff nurse for a while, a few years back. And so I certainly have a lot of respect. In fact, you have an event coming up this weekend, right?
We do, Saturday night from 5 to 7 at the Old Labor Hall in Barrie. We're celebrating 25 years.
25 years of providing excellent free health care pretty much to all comers. Is that, yeah.
It is. And I also want to say, along with dental services, I can also help them get vouchers for free extractions, help them get dental Medicaid, get vouchers for vouchers for money toward free dentures and partials. And I also have a program I found last year that is specifically designed to get free dentures for veterans.
Yeah, this is a really, I want to just take a minute here and tell you what I know about People's Health and Wellness Clinic from my wife having worked there. They not only provide, some basic health care services right there, both dental and medical, et cetera, but they also can set you up with more extensive services if you need. And that is a really key role these folks play in the, and so, Joanne, thank you for the call and a reminder about this upcoming event at the Labor Hall in Barrie, 5 to 7 p.m. Saturday. It's the 25th anniversary dinner and fundraiser for People's Health and Wellness Clinic. That's great.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. And Robert Burke, just a minute or so to go here. What any last word you want people to know about your office and the State Office of Veterans Affairs?
If you have questions, please reach out to us and perhaps we can help you or we can point you in the right direction. I think a lot of people often mistake us for the federal VA, but we're the state, but we're here to help.
And you can get people going in the right direction. That's great. Robert Burke, Director of the Vermont Office of Veterans Affairs, thank you very much for being my guest this morning on the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for allowing me to join you, Dave.
All righty. We're going to go to top of the hour news from CBS. Then Steve Dorsey from CBS is going to be joining me for a one-on-one conversation. And then we're going to have some conversations with Margaret McLean and Dave Kelly about Act 46, the school consolidation law upcoming. Stay with us, folks.
We hear a lot about shopping local, and here in the Mad River Valley, we put our money where our mouths are. Make your holiday shopping a joyful adventure far from the press and stress of the big box stores. Come to the Mad River Valley and experience the joys and charms of a quintessential New England holiday. Stores, bars, and restaurants to fill a day trip, or take a few ski runs before heading into Warren or Waitsfield for lunch or a snack while checking off the items on your list. At the Warren store, you'll find something for everyone. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, where we're fun, funky, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and as much as I love the CBS News at the top of the hour and the bottom of the hour that we get here at WDEV, FM, and AM, we also lately have been able to avail ourselves of one-on-one conversations with some individual CBS correspondents, and boy, is that a good thing. And we have one on the phone with us this morning. I believe it is Steve Dorsey. Is that right?
That's right, since 1987.
Well... the veteran Steve Dorsey. That's great. Hey, we wanted to talk with you about the impeachment inquiry. I saw some stuff over the weekend wherein Republicans are clamoring to bring in Hunter Biden as a witness. Is that going to be a happening thing? And maybe some other people the Republicans think might be able to torpedo this whole narrative?
Yeah, Hunter Biden, the whistleblower himself, other folks relevant to this natural gas company in Ukraine, in which Hunter Biden was on the board. But I think the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, has made it clear that they won't entertain those guests because they believe it will just politicize these controversial investigations that Republicans have been calling on to investigate the Bidens.
And the, is there much merit to here? I mean, is there a reason to investigate the Bidens? Did the Republicans have a legitimate line of inquiry here?
You know, I think Republicans would say it's fair to investigate the business dealings of the vice president's son during the Obama-Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
But Democrats and defenders of the Biden say, hey, listen, there was no wrongdoing here. This is just buying into the president's distractions, and this is just buying into these dirty politics.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to figure out who's right, basically.
Well, of course.
I guess one thing about this is that if you draw an analogy to any other proceeding, say in a criminal court, where there's a charge against a person, and that person might want to bring in any number of other potentially culpable people to try to take the spotlight off of themselves. Could people make that analogy here? Therefore say no, this is about a specific course of conduct that we're looking at, which is that undertaken by President Trump and his people. Is that the argument?
I think that's a legitimate argument, and I think that the Democrats in Congress would say their primary focus is holding the president accountable and holding the federal government and the executive branch accountable as part of their constitutional oversight, and this is what they're focusing on. So I think Republicans will have a hard time trying to convince the Democratic-led majority in this committee to call these controversial witnesses. But I think perhaps there could be some concessions in allowing to cross-examine witnesses, more freedom to release certain documents or subpoena evidence. But I don't think many of these witnesses have much of a shot at showing up.
And then the other question is, how long is this procedure going to take? If the House ends up sending articles of impeachment to the Senate, when will that likely happen?
Well, there's been reports that that could come as early as January, and then a Senate trial would begin. But again, this is a completely different chamber controlled by Republicans, and we expect a very different process. And we've already seen some Republicans, including Lindsey Graham, who helped lead the impeachment inquiry of former President Clinton, say he's not going to read the transcripts of these closed door interviews with witnesses. So far, he already thinks this is a sham.
Yeah, it's kind of. I think you'd want to read the transcripts before arriving at that conclusion. Maybe you arrive at that conclusion after doing so. But boy, this seems to be closing the door rather early. Speaking of which, I saw a report a couple of weeks ago that there was an indication that maybe the Senate would try to really short circuit this and perhaps, you know, have some kind of a motion for dismissal out of the gate and not really put on a full trial. Is there still any talk of that, or do you think a full trial is in the cards?
Well, you know, these days it's the Wild West of politics in Washington. Old paradigms no longer apply, so that's possible. But I think we've heard Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell say that if this does survive the House, the Senate is obligated to take up. There could be a short-circuiting in the time frame in how fast this process moves and how much attention Republicans pay to it. But I think you will see this matter addressed in some way, shape, or form in the Senate.
Is there a reason that the Republicans would want to get it done as quickly as possible so as just to limit the time that's in the headlines?
Exactly, because that's important with the president's reelection campaign.
Yeah.
Because also remember that they're up against the clock, several of the Democrats in the Senate against the first primaries and caucuses in Iowa and New Hampshire. So they likely want to get this done early because, you know, Senator Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, folks like those want to get out there. And
Kamala Harris, yeah. Cory Booker.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, half the Senate is running for the Democratic nomination.
Exactly. So it's in their interest, too, to get on the campaign trail and out of the Senate.
That is interesting. And I wonder if the rest of their Democratic colleagues will heed that, or whether they will say, hey, no, wait a minute, we have important work to do here. Let's really give this the thorough presentation that it deserves. Do you have any sense of where the Democratic caucus would want to go on that?
I think you'll see some intra-party fighting.
Yeah.
But I think by then, we'll have a closer idea of what political presidential ambitions are at stake here. You know, does Cory Booker last? Does the campaign of Kamala Harris? Well, she's already cutting staff in New Hampshire. So will they survive, and will it be as much of as big of a deal to most Democrats, excluding, you know, Bernie Sanders? So that's going to be a key friction point, I think.
All right. Well, Steve Dorsey of CBS News, thanks so much for joining me this morning. Always good chatting with you and getting some further insight there.
And happy Veterans Day.
All right. You too. Dave Kelly is an attorney, lives in Greensboro, and he has been involved in a lot of public issues over around Vermont over the years. In fact, I think he was the Republican nominee for governor back in, let me see if I get the year right, 1994.
Your memory's better than mine, Dave.
And Dave Kelly, you are now very active as an attorney representing some of the critics of the Act 46 school consolidation, school governance consolidation law here in Vermont. And I'm sure we'll be hearing why you are taking that position in the next little while here. My other guest here is Margaret McLean. Margaret is lives in Peacham and is a longtime educator herself. In fact, just told me during the break that she's heading off to Japan shortly to do some consulting over in that country about educational issues and so on. And so, and Margaret is also a longtime teacher and actually held a seat on the State Board of Education for a time, if I recall correctly. So, Margaret McLean, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Dave.
All righty. So, let's start with you, Margaret. Why are you here?
I'm here because for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been volunteering around the issue of Act 46. I was a school principal in Vermont, and after being a school principal, I went to work for the Rural School and Community Trust, which is a national organization that supports rural students and rural schools and communities. And when I did that, I got to go all around the country to look at rural schools and communities. And while I worked with the teachers, we also had a policy program. And so over the years, I learned a lot about school consolidation in different states. And when this came up in Vermont, I testified in 2013 and 2014 because I was hoping that Vermont could avoid the pitfalls that have been in other states around consolidation. And
what's the number one pitfall, would you say?
School closures and depletion of rural schools and communities, the impact on rural communities. I think that, you know, Vermont has 54.9% of its students who attend rural schools. And what's significant about that is it is the largest number in the nation, 54.9%. But that means 45% of kids in Vermont don't go to rural schools. They go to more urban and suburban schools. And different kinds of schools work best in different kinds of environments. And, you know, in your urban areas, you have neighborhood schools and magnet schools like Burlington has, and that's an appropriate model for that kind of environment. And in suburbs, you often have schools where there are, you know, K-2 in one building and 3-5 in another building and in a middle school and a high school. And that works in suburbs. But in rural areas, community schools that are the heart of the community are a bedrock of how rural communities function, and they're very important, not just to children and families, but also to community economic viability.
Dave Kelly, I noticed that when I drive around your neck of the woods up there in the Northeast Kingdom, or places like Stockbridge and other places where I can sort of picture myself driving past the local school on the two-lane blacktop that is the one main road through town. It occurs to me that in some places the school is really it in that community. I mean, there's just not much else going on. You could say the largest industry is the pizza making operation in the school cafeteria, tell us a little bit about the nature of that relationship and the economic importance of the school as an actual employer and linchpin of these local economies.
Well, I'm not just talking about my opinion in this case. There's just an overwhelming body of research that indicates clearly when you take a small rural community and you take the school out of that community, the consequences are devastating. The ability to attract young families with children shrinks enormously. Those families don't want to put their kids on hour-long bus rides to go to a school in another community. And that means the businesses that support those small rural communities have a hard time attracting the kind of people they need to sustain them, especially today in a new information economy where you need young, well-educated people. You find that property values go down, the tax base shrinks. And so what happens is you get what I would call an Appalachia effect. You start to hollow out and ghettoize rural areas. The schools are particularly important in rural areas and in a small community because the students from the most economically disadvantaged families do far, far better in a small school where they can be part of a community and that school is in their community where their parents are more likely to be engaged with their educations.
So Tom Lyson, he was a researcher in New York State,
mm-hmm.
and he did a study of school closures in upstate New York and compared those communities to communities that kept their schools. And his evidence shows that there was loss of property value, loss of economic viability, population loss without the schools in comparison to the places that kept the schools. They're not just good economically, though. They're good for kids. In these communities, particularly with families from poverty, and Vermont has a fairly high percentage of childhood poverty, the children are really well known. All children are needed. Everyone's needed to be on the soccer team, for example. Kids who might not play in a larger school are needed in that small school. They're encouraged to come out and play. And the multi-year knowledge that teachers and principals gain about their families and their lives and how they support them can all play into that child's education and add value to that child's education. So kids do well in small schools.
Let me ask you something about the downside, though, because small schools oftentimes have trouble fielding sports teams merely because, you know, if you only have four kids who want to play basketball, you can't put out a basketball team. It takes five.
Well, I'm talking primarily about community schools that are elementary schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Vermont, we, for the most part, have community elementary schools. And in some cases, that's K-2, K-4, K-6, K-8. And then we have middle and high schools. And many of the middle and high schools have been unionized for 50 years. We do send our older children on buses to high school and in some cases to middle school.
By unionized, that's not a labor term. That you're referring here to the school district, the multiple,
unified district.
The multiple,
yes,
multiple
union.
Town, the school union districts as they're called.
Right. Right.
Just I wanted to clarify that.
So. Yeah. So what I was talking about was young children going to school close to home, not going on long bus rides. Middle and high school kids are better able to cope with those.
The difficult situations that many of these small towns are facing, I mean, I think there's an argument that could be made that perhaps these small towns are just essentially not workable anymore, that they kind of need to shrivel up and go away and have populations consolidated. I mean, think about the other forces that push in that direction. One would be climate change. You're going to want to do less transportation, so a less rural situation for the population might be better in that regard. And another thing that you know people are frequently point to is that just that critical mass. You know, I mean, if you have a small school, again, you know, even if you're trying to put together a school band and there aren't any trombone players, what do you do then?
Go ahead.
The important thing about this is to think about the kind of Vermont we want in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that makes Vermont distinct is its rural nature and rural communities. The fact that 54% of kids go to rural schools is evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the character and landscape of Vermont. And people don't move to Vermont for their suburbs. They move for a way of life and a quality of life. And with decent internet access, etc., you can live in a rural place in the kingdom or elsewhere, and you can work remotely. So schools are needed in these communities to be attractive to those folks. Peacham, for example, has a lot of 30-year-olds who have chosen either to return to Peacham or have chosen Peacham. And one of the big reasons why they've chosen Peacham is this: is the school. These community schools are attractive to families, and it's a reason many, many young folks move here. And we need to attract more people like that, not try and become Massachusetts.
I think the reality is actually just the opposite of what you described, Dave. I was in Boston 2 weeks ago, and I can't imagine why anybody would ever want to live in that city or spend 2 hours in a traffic jam trying to get to work in the morning. Now that we have the technology that allows a lot of some of the best educated people in the world to take advantage of the assets of living in a rural community close to wildlife and close to the recreation opportunities, I think many more people would certainly rather live in Greensboro, Vermont than in the concrete canyons of New York City. And I think that we should start to begin to prepare to take advantage of that. I think rural is an asset. It's not a liability. And people, I think people like me are living examples of why that's the case.
And you mentioned about the trombone player. Well, Newark, Vermont, for example, has a Balkan chorus. Not every school needs or should have a Balkan chorus, but they've been on National Public Radio, and yeah, they have albums and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there may not be an opportunity for you to play the trombone, but there may be an opportunity for you to have rich musical experience in your small elementary school that's in a rural place.
Well, here's an interesting question from someone who emailed us this morning saying they had a question they would like to ask David Kelly and Margaret McLean. I am from southeast the portion of the state, and Act 46 has caused immense disruption in some of the supervisor unions around here. I would like their take on what should be done to make it easier for schools to remain open and the needs of the communities to be met. Thanks, Dan MacArthur from Marlboro. It's a question which I think it really is pretty key here. Are there particular strategies that you recommend for if you're in a town where you think, oh boy, they might be trying to close my school, what should you do?
Well, Dan's from Marlboro, and Marlboro is a community like Peacham that has retained local governance. There's about 50 districts in Vermont that were not merged and that have a local school board. So Dan is fortunate, as are the people in Peacham, is that they can make local decisions about this. And so they can all put their heads together. The issues of declining enrollment and costs are, they're not going away. They're a reality. And there's a myriad of ways to tackle them. And Dan and Marlboro as a community can look and have a go at tackling them. So for one example, in Peacham, a community group has got together and created a nonprofit, Peacham Children's Center, and they're looking to work with a provider to provide childcare 0 to 3 after school and summer programming in town to supplement school programming. So people are choosing to move to our town because of our school. It's one of the reasons. It's even more attractive if there is early childhood care 0 to 3 available in town. They don't have to drive to another town to leave their infant elsewhere. So I think towns have to look creatively at what will attract families and what will make their schools more viable. And Peacham and Marlboro are fortunate that they're in a position that they can make those decisions because they're not part of a larger merged structure.
They haven't been required to merge. Let me just bring in a caller here before the break. I do want to do that. Cindy from Callis is on the phone.
Hi, this is Cindy Gardner-Morse. I'm calling from Callis. Speaking of Peacham, that brings up my first question. Peacham somehow had an exemption from the Act 46. Callis in our district also asked for an exemption, and we seem to not have it, although, as you know, this is in a court case. When I go to our meetings, when I hear people talk about it, we're being referred to as a unified district, which we're not until the court case is settled. We're still waiting for that determination. So I just wanted to say that this feels like taxation without representation. The folks in our town, in our district, are really frustrated about this. My own taxes here in Callis have gone up something like 5 or 6%, while taxes in my neighboring town, East Montpelier, have gone down significantly. Now, Callis and Worcester are the two poorer towns in the district. We're picking up the tab for East Montpelier and Berlin, which are wealthier towns.
Well, you're picking up millions of dollars in worth of a tab,
$8
million from East Montpelier, in fact.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is, taxation without representation. You didn't have any vote. The unelected State Board of Education just decided to lop $8 million worth of tax debt onto Callis. And I think that's inappropriate. I think in Vermont, just like the current chair of the State Board of Education has said, Vermonters will lose their respect for participatory democracy if we let things like this continue. John Carroll was clear. He told the board before they issued their final order they'd gone off the tracks.
Cindy, thank you for the call. I really appreciate it.
I have one more question. I want to know who's tracking this. It's supposed to be saving us money. The study that they did said it was not going to save money. That study is buried. It's impossible to find that study now. But who is keeping track of how much money is allegedly being saved?
Well, actually, nobody is at this point.
All right, I got to cut it there because we have to go to a bottom of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Going to hear some words from CBS, a couple words from our sponsors, and be back with more of this conversation. Fred from Barry's on the line, but Fred, be patient. We'll be talking with you after the break.
Take the stress out of holiday shopping at the almost world-famous Warren Store. We have something for everyone on your list, from toys to beer, jewelry to wine, clothing to Yule logs. We have a wide selection of outerwear for men and women, all at 25% off from some of your favorite brands, such as Kool, Royal Robbins, Prana, Save the Duck, and more. Holiday cards, wrap, candles, pottery, snow globes, always friendly, knowledgeable customer service, and free gift wrapping. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli, then head upstairs to shopping heaven. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back and continuing our conversation with Margaret McLean and Dave Kelly about Act 46 and its aftermath, that of course being the school consolidation law here in Vermont. And I want to bring Fred from Barry on in just a moment, but first I want Margaret to finish a point I think she was in the middle of in response to the last caller.
Yes, Cindy. So, Cindy, Callis and your district, Washington Central, that's one of the reasons that you and 13 other towns in the same position as you, which had debt foisted on you, proposed an alternative plan to merger. And the State Board chose not to give those alternative plans a chance. They chose to merge wherever possible, not wherever necessary, which the law stated. So that's why there is the lawsuit, and that issue will be decided in the Supreme Court coming up. But you're correct that you now are given the debt from the other towns in your district that had debt, and that your community and Worcester are the poorer communities, and that without a vote, the debt has been placed on you, and there are 13 towns like you around the state.
Okay, I do want to bring in Fred, who I think, if he's still there, gets today's award for patience. Good morning, Fred.
Hey, good morning. I had a couple of things I'd like to touch on.
Yep.
When you merge these schools, how many teachers get laid off? None. They just go to administration or principals, or they don't. You lose a job in a union. The teachers' union in Vermont has no money in it. Every year you borrow $250 million to pay the pension of the teachers that are retired who are marrying the same-sex person where it all started from. They want to pass their union on to some 20-year-old they married, and that's going to be paid for another 40 years. Right now, if I retired, I have to be 68 years old. I can't be 65. I can't be 62. Or I won't get nothing at all. And then you want to go on to union daycare. you passed the Union Bank here. So we're just, Vermont is now Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New York inundated. You can't drive down the road. The roads are torn up because they got so much traffic. And the global warming is the biggest joke in the world, because when you cut the tree down, that produces the oxygen.
All right, Fred, well, you're covering a lot of issues here. I want to give our guests a chance to respond to a couple of them.
Well,
thank you for the call.
I think Fred does raise a good issue when he talks about our pension funds, because I think everybody understands they're seriously underfunded to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. And if Vermont doesn't get a little bit wiser in the way we manage money, that will turn out to be a big problem.
And you're right, Fred, in that one of the goals of the law was about looking at economics, but no one's tracking the goals of the law. The goals of the law are actually probably the best thing about the law, that the goals are to, you know, increase transparency, increase opportunity, to monitor costs, but no one's measuring how we're doing on those. It's kind of like they felt like, okay, we'll put in this change in governance and miraculously these goals will be achieved. Well, that's just not how it works in the real world. And our eyes are not on the prize. The prize are the goals, and not the structure. And we need to be able to focus on those. And if we were, things like staffing would be being looked at. Probably before closing a school, staffing would be looked at closely.
Margaret, let me ask you, do you have the goals? Because I think some people might need a refresher.
Okay. So there's a goal about transparency, and it's a tricky goal to get your head around, but town meeting is a transparent way of governing, because people can ask questions, people can see line item budgets, people can adjust the budget from the floor. There is an opportunity for communities to be involved in shaping the budget. With these large budgets of merged districts, that kind of goes away, because you no longer have a school town meeting. You maybe have a public informational meeting, but you vote by Australian ballot, perhaps on a different day. And the budgets, instead of being multi-page line item budgets, are often one page, and for $34 million, not for $3 million, say. So it's much more difficult to get your head around where savings could come.
There were five goals. The five goals were good academic outcomes, affordability, accountability, transparency, and equity. And if you looked at those goals, we have schools, Montgomery, Franklin, for example, those schools have some of the best outcomes at some of the best prices with growing student populations in the state of Vermont. There was no reason to merge those schools, none whatsoever, but the board went ahead and did it anyway. Now we've created a situation where the big towns can plunder the little towns. If you have the political power, you can take the tuition dollars out of your neighbors. It doesn't matter how affordable they are or how great their academic outcomes are. We've created a system that basically encourages plundering. It's silly.
You know, one of the things that Fred, our last caller mentioned global warming or climate change with some degree of skepticism, but one of the things that has occurred to me from time to time about Act 46 actually has to do with this, because I think about our own situation. I live in Montpelier, and we ended up merging with the Roxbury School District just from the point of view of transportation and how many hydrocarbons are going to be spewed out of tailpipes, whether it's school buses or parents going to sporting events and band concerts. Would have made more sense, it seems, from that perspective, to maybe merge with Berlin, which borders Montpelier. Or maybe if not Berlin, how about Northfield? That's the next town down. But no, we had to go all the way to Roxbury, which is on the other side of Northfield, to find a town to merge with. And now there's a lot of transportation happening back and forth on Route 12 every day, which is, has anybody actually looked at the impact of that from the point of view of all this state effort to try to combat climate change?
Well, as we centralize more and more schools, that problem is only going to get exacerbated. That's a big problem. It's not just about climate change and increased carbon. It's increased cost. Those buses cost money. The gasoline costs money. And it's one of the reasons this hasn't worked in places like Maine and in West Virginia.
You know, on the other hand, I do hear from people that out in the Dakotas, kids frequently travel an hour or more to school.
I used to live in Montana. I lived in a place where kids do travel long distances.
There are kids in Vermont who travel an hour to school now.
Sure, from Island Pond.
Yeah.
And so that's not necessarily good. And one of the great things about modern technology is that we can reduce that. We can have classrooms in Ripton, Vermont, with access to the greatest resources in the country. They can have access to programs at MIT. They can have access to programs in India. My wife teaches English. When she's teaching the Kite Runner, she has kids in her classroom meeting with kids in classrooms in Pakistan. I coach high school debate. I would have my kids practice with students from Boston Latin, and we would do it via Skype. We have technologies that we need to make much better use of, and we don't need a lot more buses and a lot more transportation.
Margaret McLean, tell us about Peacham and its offerings in terms of what's your general catchment area? In other words, are kids coming in from neighboring towns to go to Peacham?
There actually are a few at this point because we did not merge because we operate differently from our neighbors. Our neighbors are K-8 and we are K-6. And Peacham values school choice from 7 through 12 and chose not to change how we operate. Therefore, we couldn't merge. But as part of our plan, which was approved by the state board, we agreed to a limited school choice option. And so there are students from other schools who choose to come to Peacham. We don't get any revenue from those students coming. But we have space in some classes so we can take those students. And it's great to have more children in our school. Currently, we have 68 students pre-K through 6.
Dave Kelly, I wonder whether, I mean, Peacham sounds like a good example of this, but I wonder whether some of what we're dealing with here is almost like an economic critical mass situation where if you have an attractive whatever, you're going to draw people and it's going to strengthen itself over time. Is that some of what, I mean, the magic is happening at Peacham. It's not happening in where Calais maybe or some other place.
The difference is Peacham retained its local governance and Calais and Ferrisburg and Addison and Faiston and these other towns didn't. They're part of a larger merged structure where they have little power on the merge board and the larger town can make decisions for them.
And I think Calais has a great elementary school. I think the poorest part of Vermont is the Northeast Kingdom, where I live. And the Northeast Kingdom is at a crossroads. Right now, we have a new emerging agricultural economy with the Center for an Agricultural Economy, with Pete's Greens, with Jasper Hill Cheese, Hill Farmstead Brewery. And we have the beginnings of a really remarkable time in the Vermont economy. But like I said, we're at a crossroads. And if we begin to take our elementary schools away from the towns that are critical to the prosperity of this new agricultural economy, I think we're going to do a lot of damage and start to go backwards instead of forwards. But we have enormous opportunities, and those opportunities depend very much on the kind of schools we offer to the people that are going to support those new businesses.
That little hub you just talked about involving Jasper Hill Cheese and these other companies, and not to mention the Highland Center for the Arts, which is a huge new
which
boon.
Is an incredible asset to the Northeast Kingdom.
Yeah. Those assets are, it seems as though you've got the workings or the beginnings anyway of a new economic resurgence or maybe surgence if it's never happened before.
And you can feel it. I grew up in Vermont. I remember traveling up to the Northeast Kingdom with my dad. I remember passing through Hardwick and actually feeling sorry for that town. I grew up in Pittsford, which was not exactly the heart of prosperity, but passing through Hardwick was difficult. Come to Hardwick today, and you can feel the vibrancy and the kind of new optimism and some of the results of this economy. It's Vermont Natural Coatings. It's Vermont Soy. It's the Craftsbury Outdoor Center. It's Circus Smirkus. There's just so much going on that the Northeast Kingdom has a real opportunity to become one of the most attractive rural areas in the country.
And you need schools for it to stay that way. You know, Jasper Hill employs over 90 employees. They don't want to be living far away and driving. They want to be living in Greensboro or very close by. They need schools for their children to go to.
And one of the things I hear bubbling up from different places around Vermont is a sense of frustration from folks who feel like that their democracy has been damaged. The idea that you used to go and vote on issues related to your schools and how you voted was how things played out. And that's not so much the case anymore, Margaret McLean, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, democracy matters, and it's a Vermonters hold it dear through town meeting and being able to voice opinions. And you don't necessarily always get your own way, but you can be heard and have a voice in decision making. So in Act 46, a number of towns voluntarily merged. They chose to merge. And that is fine, and away they go with that. I mean, some of them are finding out the pitfalls of merger. Like last week, there was a vote in Addison and Ferrisburg to retain their schools. But they chose to merge. Well, 90 districts decided they wouldn't merge, and that merging was not in the best interests for them. And instead, they created alternative plans to merger, which met the goals of the law, and they voted on merger. Some places rejected merger one, twice, three, four times. Orwell voted four times. I know that other towns voted multiple times, and these are worn votes of the electorate.
Well, Orwell voted four times against merging.
Yes.
And what happened?
The state board recommended that Orwell be merged, and Orwell was merged by the Slate Valley District.
That is Orwellian. I'm sorry, but I shouldn't go there. But, you know, I think when you have four local votes to not to merge, and then the state board comes in and says, merge, and you must merge, and you do end up merging, something's broken.
Well, that didn't just happen in Orwell. That happened for many towns. The towns in the lawsuit, for the most part, they voted, and they voted no, and they presented viable alternative plans. And the state had an opportunity there. They could have approved these alternative plans, which were listed towards the goals of the law, and they could have said, you've got 3 years to try these alternative plans. Mm-hmm. Show us how you do. And if you're meeting those goals and you're improving and better meeting those goals, keep your governance structure, which is dear to your heart. If you can't meet the goals of the law through your alternative plan, we'll merge you in 3 years or we'll merge you in 5 years. But the state board chose not to do that. The state board chose to merge people anyway, regardless of their locally won votes. And I think that they felt that they had a right to do that. But was it a wise thing for them to do? I don't think so, because it sends a very message to these union boards, which are not constructed fairly with equity in terms of voice for all towns. So Ferrisburg and Addison voted last week and voted no on closing their school. But next year, that board will not be required to respect Addison and Ferrisburg's votes. That board can make a decision like the state board did to just merge them, to close them anyway.
I think
this is a precedent set by the state board, which I think is dangerous. I think democracy matters to Vermonters and should be respected. And I have no problems with mergers if people vote for merger, but I do have problems with local votes being overrided.
I think it's important to underscore the fact that Section 9 of the law provided for these proposals and these plans. And at the time of the passage of the law, Senator Cummings, who was the chair of the Senate Ed Committee and the reporter of the bill, said, if you can demonstrate that you're providing a high-quality education at an affordable price, you're home free. Then Senator Zuckerman said, our bill says if your small school does it well, financially and with outcomes, you don't have to change a thing. The senator from Caledonia County, Mr. Benning, said, if you are indeed a small school and you are indeed operating in an efficient way, and you're feeling that your children are in fact getting a proper education, then this bill seeks to leave you alone. But I'm going to hold myself and hopefully all of us to continuing that promise. But instead of honoring those Section 9 proposals, the State Board did not approve one single Section 9 proposal. They merged wherever it was possible, and that was a huge mistake.
Laura Schaller is a listener and has emailed the station here to ask, in the Harwood Unified Union School District, that sounds repetitively redundant, I've got to say. In the Harwood Unified Union School District, Waterbury not only gets 4 seats on the merge board, but their votes are weighted more heavily than the rest of the towns. I get that they should have more reps per their population, but is it fair or legal to receive both?
You know, stop and think about this. What we did was we had an unelected appointed board designing governance structures for school districts around the state. Now, I have great respect for teachers. I'm married to a teacher. But to have a high school sociology teacher and some high school students and some other lay people designing governance for school districts around the state, these people had no expertise in that area, and they shouldn't have been doing it.
Well, you can petition, the caller from Waterbury, you can petition for a change in the Articles of Agreement of your unified district to change representation. I know a lot of the districts that merged quickly, like Harwood and the Addison districts, they have pretty flimsy Articles of Agreement. And districts that merged later were more thorough in the articles they adopted. Many districts have articles that protect schools, require a vote of the town before a school is closed in perpetuity. So you can petition for your articles to change and change that representation.
Boy, the email queue is just heating up here, folks, and we've only got about 3 minutes to go on this episode of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. I'm sorry to say, because I'm sure we could go all day on this topic. Now that the folks from the Harwood District are weighing in, Laura Schaller, by the way, is not from Waterbury. She's from Moortown, which I could kind of tell she wasn't from Waterbury by the fact she was complaining about Waterbury getting too much representation on the HUUSD board. So there you go. That's but we also have a I think I had another email from someone in the looks like my name is Caroline Griffin. I am a resident of North Ferrisburg, and I have 2 children who attend Ferrisburg Central School. 3 days before school started in August, we heard the news for the first time that the school board was considering closing our school along with Addison Central and moving all the kids into Virgin's by the next school year. Our communities were thrown into a panic given the rushed timeline and lack of a plan from the district. Our town just had a vote on November 5th. Thankfully, there was an unprecedented voter turnout in a non-election year, and the results were 160 for closure and 884 opposed. Despite the tremendous support for the school to remain open, we are still very much in jeopardy. Our state reps don't seem to think there's anything that can be done at the state level since our district voluntarily merged. How can we continue to protect our beloved elementary school that is truly the heart of our town without any assurance from our elected leaders?
There's 2 things that can be done, one at the local level and one at the state level. At the local level, you can petition to change your articles of agreement to require a vote of the community before school closure in perpetuity. And at the state level, Act 46 says 3 times, nothing about this law is intended to close schools. Well, those are just words. They're very nice words, but that's all they are, words, because nothing in the law currently is a mechanism to make sure those words are a reality.
Those words are going to have to be the last words, unfortunately, okay, because we are at the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show and WDEV FM and AM. Thank you so much, Margaret McLean and Dave Kelly, for stopping by this morning. always a lively conversation about Act 46. That's about it for the Dave Graham Show here. Stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and tune in tomorrow for another edition of our program about 9:05. We'll talk to you all then. Have a great day, everybody.